Welcome to Transformers, the podcast about how business people and policymakers are creating a sustainable future. I'm your host, Kai Embren.
When politicians argue engineers built, while the world's attention is consumed by geopolitical chaos, a generation of innovators is quietly rewiring how we power our lives. Away from fossil fuels toward something cleaner, faster, and increasingly unstoppable. The numbers are extraordinary. In 2026, 116 million electric cars, buses, vans, and heavy trucks are forecast to be on the road globally. That is a 30% increase year on year. Grid-scale battery storage is tripling in some markets. The transition is no longer a projection, it's happening now. My guest today has spent her career at exactly that intersection of science, industry, and strategy. She trained in Sweden, built companies in the United States, and has been thinking about battery architecture since most of us were still debating whether electrical cars would even work. Kristina Lampe-Önerud is the founder and the CEO of Candensa Innovation, a PhD from Uppsala University, postdoc at MIT, and one of the most important voices in the global battery conversation. Kristina, welcome to Transformers.
Thank you, Kai, for having me at this Transformers podcast.
When you look at what's happening to battery deployment globally in the last 24 months, the scale, the speed, are you surprised? And what's driving this beyond just electrical car story?
Yes, both surprised, delighted, and energized. The battery revolution was, of course, started in the 1700s by early scientists, but the battery space really took off in 1850 when you had lead acid all of a sudden powering elements of the economy. And then to stay still here, be here still, is really amazing, actually. When you think about how hard it is to construct a battery, to think about the innovation cycle, and if you make it commercially, how long you can stay. So 1850 to 2026, that's a long time. And I think we should hold that in some level of both humility and to be honored by awesome technologies just sticking with us when we debate the upcoming technologies. Nickel cadmium was invented in Sweden, actually, in the late 1800s, still here in some minor applications. And then lithium ion came along in the 1970s. Started in Europe and Bell Labs in the United States with a lot of innovators thinking about just the ease of lithium as an ion charge carrier, how small it was, element number three, and how easily it could shift. And this was commercialized in the 90s by the Japanese. Sony was first. The Japan kind of ecosystem took off and surrounded itself by all levels of innovation and commercialization engines, only to be followed by South Korea in the early 2000s, to then be followed by the Chinese in the mid-2000s. And with the tectonic shifts in technology that has happened before, with partnerships and market forces, where there were times where all of us were collaborating, and now at times where there's a ton of tension, I think it's foremost important to hold. When you have a technology that has been commercialized at global scale, it is really important that that technology gets held with a veneer and the opportunity that lead acid kind of taught us. Lithium ion is here for a really long time. It's super powerful. I am therefore delighted, as you know, I did my PhD on lithium ion with vanadium oxides in the 90s and had then an opportunity to follow all of these opportunities. I've invented nickel materials, carbon materials, so like cathodes and anodes, really high performance in lithium ion. I've been part of developing electrolytes, cell formats, various types of packs and modules and applications. And it is just really delightfully cool to sit back, have a cup of tea, and just look at everything that has happened. And yet, as an innovator, I'm frustrated because it could be much, much faster if we collaborated more and if we had better policy together and all that stuff. And I suspect that is what we'll talk about.
You mentioned collaboration and supply chains. Sodium ion batteries like Kettle's Nuxtra avoid lithium and cobalt entirely. From a geopolitical and supply chain perspective, how significant is that? And when you look at who controls the raw materials today, what worries you?
I think in general, there are enough materials on Earth to fuel a more sustainable energy equation. Full stop. The question is, who dominates those materials and who is willing to trade around this? So this is coming back to, do we think we have a sustainability crisis and a technology crisis through AI, or is this an opportunity that we should just take hold of? Either of those would basically promote collaboration. And I think on some levels, we are at that collaborative stage, and yet we have a lot of voices and influencers right now that prevents that. But on the mining industry, as you know, I served on the board of Syrah Resources for carbon materials and helped establish the largest carbon facility manufacturing in the United States, which is a pure play owned by a private company mining in Mozambique, Africa, and refining in the United States. Wonderful and interesting journey. Of course, it's very notable that the Chinese have been buying up very strategically lots of resources and is also very skilled at mining and extraction and refinement. So in a perfect world, we collaborate, not an issue. Where we lock down opportunities, it takes a long time to build out mines, takes a long time to get them commercially feasible. We would see more collaboration on this. We'll see how that goes. Today, we have trade that is somewhat limited, but still trade. I also served on the startup that came out of FMC in the United States on lithium. They started a company called Livent. I was on the board for that. We later moved together with an Australian company, Allkem. So it became the biggest play in lithium in the Western Hemisphere, with mines in and resources in South America, North America, and Australia. And we sold the company last year to Rio Tinto. So a success story in how consolidation works in the Western world and how we need to find those collaboration nodes. Very, very important. Nobody can operate as a small company unless you have an opportunity to partner with large players in this economy at this time.
Kettle just launched the world's first mass-produced sodium-ion battery. They call it Nuxtra. Sodium-ion has been almost ready for a decade. What actually changed that allowed them to bring it to mass production now? And what does it tell us about how China approaches battery innovation? Your work at Cadenza Innovation is built around an architecture-first philosophy, supercell design. When a new chemistry like sodium ion arrives, does that validate or challenge your approach? Can your design work across different chemistries?
Sodium ion has been around for a long time as well. It is one level below lithium in the periodic table, so it's a heavier charge carrier. It is it's not as agile, it is also less reactive, which is what is happening, where people think this could be much safer. It's a water-soluble solution that is wonderful, but it is a bigger system. So the systems naturally become bigger. The opportunity has been there for a long time. And I think what we're seeing now is announcements. CATL is one. There are other opportunities in China that have also been opportunities, of course, in the United States and Europe that has also been highlighted with similar approach. CATL, of course, is the biggest battery company in the world. And when they throw their weight behind a technology, people stand up to listen. But I think, again, just holding for a minute, it is really, really hard to bring a new technology into this market, especially when lithium-ion has such a grip on the global marketplace. We know how to use it. We know how to manufacture it. We have billions and billions and billions invested in CapEx and supply chain. We understand how to deploy it into opportunities in markets. So while it's very exciting that we have news in the technology side, it takes a long time to get a foothold. Look at fuel cells, invented in the 50s. It's still not really a mainstream opportunity by any stretch of the imagination. And we see some very specific opportunities. I suspect sodium will have a similar opportunity. It is bigger, it has lower energy density and lower voltage. So that is fun from a technology point of view, but it is not really a threat in any stretch of the imagination to lithium-ion's grip on the world. We have seen other opportunities, and we see a lot of different flavors of variations of small ion carriers. It is very possible that sodium has some opportunities, just like flow batteries have some opportunities, just like ice storage has some opportunity, just like hot sand has opportunity, or hydropower. It's all, if we accept that we have a very complicated energy mix, we should also expect that there are a lot of technologies that try to find their way and will solve different problems. So it's possible that sodium ion will have some opportunity, but it's not going to be on the mass scale that you see right now, frankly, still with lead acid and with lithium ion.
Let's look at the United States and compare with China. The International Energy Agency reports that the U.S. added 19 gigawatts of battery storage in 2025. That's 60% year-on-year growth. China added 63 gigawatts in the same year.
So the Chinese government has had this policy, as you know, Kai, for almost the last 30 years of a five-year incremental, here's our commitment for the next 5 years, but they stay steady. Batteries was an encouraged industry already in the 2000s, and they've stuck with it. Batteries, solar, has been really part of the core energy revolution, and the opportunity is, of course, huge for China, but it is also huge for the rest of the world. China has established an amazing set of skills now in manufacturing, for sure helped by international trade in previous years, with lots of US and European companies partnering with Chinese company on Chinese soil to make China the manufacturing engine. And maybe we're now shifting from made in China to made by China. And I think in a collaborative space, we have an energy problem to solve. We should leverage all knowledge, all resources. So I think on a top political level, where I don't play, I sit as an advisor to DOE, IVA's DOE, and I sit on the Swedish Engineering Sciences IVA Academy. I don't see loud headlines that say we must collaborate, but I do believe that that is not a sustainable headline. And I know that there are meetings under the headlines to try to facilitate. On the innovator to innovator, no question. People are trying to find ways to identify technology components that you can use or find a way to have a dialogue. World Economic Forum is doing a wonderful thing on this. As you know, I won twice the Technology Pioneer for different inventions. That's a great forum where you get a chance to meet other innovators and just recognize the moment in. But the biggest force has always been private enterprise, at least from the US and Europe. And in that sense, private enterprise in the United States or China or India or Europe is not that different. Led by entrepreneurs who see opportunities, who try to play a little better, a little faster, a little fairer than the rest of the world at the current times. And those people exist in many, many countries. And I see a lot of opportunities for collaboration at multiple places. Now, where those deployments go will matter on the local policy. So if you have strict policies where you prevent actual collaboration, that will become potentially a dead zone. Where you allow collaborators to come together, you have an opportunity to have a tech revolution, an energy revolution, a social revolution, an economic revolution, but a transformation for sure, and it will be quick.
We are now hearing strong signals from Australia, and batteries have overtaken gas peaking plants during the evening peak, and battery discharge tripled year on year. Wholesale electricity price fell 12%. When you see data like that, does it change how you think about the speed and which transition is actually happening?
Australia has, of course, a huge continent with a lot of land that is not suitable for agriculture and almost the perfect solar farm opportunity. And with solar, you need batteries if you want to have microgrids or some level of support into the grid as well. So with that, Australia has also tried to do kind of both sides of the energy equation. Coal is a massive energy resource in the country. It's a very large part of the economy, and it is a lot of trade with China. So there is an interesting relationship between Australia and China for export and also import of battery technology and batteries in general, solar technology, high tech in general. They're relatively close, and yet Australia sits with the other foot in the Western Hemisphere with allegiances to Europe and the United States. And there's some off notes in that, of course. So we'll see what happens. But I think there is a very high sense of urgency when you live in Melbourne, like a few years ago, where you have burning beaches and you had to resort to the water. That's how hot it gets. So that becomes a catastrophic event, and it prompts more action.
Christina, you are Swedish. You are trained there. You have built your career in the US. And your home country just watched its biggest industrial bet in the battery space collapse. Northvolt was Europe's great hope. Swedish-born, billions in investment, backed by Volkswagen and Goldman Sachs. Now it's in bankruptcy protection. What went wrong, and what is a lesson for Europe?
I think the big lesson is to really look at the ecosystem. So super cool to use Sweden's clean energy, wonderful to revive an opportunity in Skellefteå or Västerås for kind of tech hubs, but maybe a very difficult place to have your main manufacturing come from. So in the old days, we tried to put manufacturing close to point of deployment. Maybe there is one opportunity to think about that differently. But I think the biggest opportunity is actually to think about your technology roadmap. I think Northvolt's thesis was we're going to go in with what the world needs today, and we're going to build it greener, and we're going to build it in Europe. And that was the main thesis. I think it's hard. It has always been my advisors, my mentor's guidance to me. Unfortunately, as a newcomer, you have to be better, cheaper, and you have to have a technology roadmap. So even if you beat everybody today on whatever terms, fair or unfair, that's where you enter. And you have to have a technology roadmap to be even better and even cheaper. And you can define the metrics. What cheap is that price? Is that opportunity? Is that time to market? Is that service? Is like, what is it? But there has to be an increased value proposition. And I think it was amazing to see how quickly the Northvolt team and Goldman Sachs raised all this money, how they validated something very, very quickly, and then got over its skis a little bit to It's dangerous to deploy too much capital too quickly because you disappoint. And having done manufacturing a few times, there are always issues, especially in the startup phase. And if you don't have the yield, you lose your shirt.
And now to the last question, Christina. If you have to name one breakthrough, technical, policy, or commercial, that you expect to see in the next 3 years that most people are not yet paying attention to, what would it be?
I see amazing opportunities in technologies, in incremental opportunities built around lithium-ion. I think we're in a deployment phase, and it completely dominates what we're doing. My hope is in the commercial world. I think when things are chaotic, movers and shakers, so people, make the difference. And the entrepreneurs have a unique ability and a proven track record of navigating choppy waters. And I think the secret sauce to what good looks like in the future is, or in the near future, is having innovation, really disruptive technologies with a value proposition that meets multiple elements of the market, backed by true need, not saying I need a battery for a car one day. I need a battery now for this specific application with these specific specifications. These are my needs. And when those two combine and the customer is somewhat large, and you have an innovator that can meet that, that is also not just a PowerPoint company. So I think that's the other toxin, by the way, hyperbole. You have to say what you have. And yet I find it, of course, very frustrating when I'm trying to do that. And many of the industry players are completely overstating their capability. But when those two are true, the innovator says, here's what I have, here's how I can meet your needs. And the customer is clear on the needs, you can have an amazing speed to market, an amazing partnership. And then the insecurities in policy and the noise in new technologies go away.
Christina Lampe-Önnerud, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm Kai Embren. Follow me on Twitter and LinkedIn, where I will be announcing the future guests to this podcast. And you can expect about 2 programs a month. And each guest has a unique story of making business and society sustainable. So find out more. Visit my homepage, kaiembren.org. Thank you for listening.